Kaluza-Klein theory by talking about the Kaluza-Klein monopole. So this is a very topological morning, I have to say. Although I actually prefer this particular topology over here with bananas and chocolate, but nonetheless, this is quite a nice little piece of mathematics coming up. And this was discovered by Gross, Perry, and Sorkin. So Perry you've met, Sorkin is here at the Perimeter Institute, and David Gross is down in Santa Barbara. So for a magnetic black hole, the idea is to do what you did for the Ryson and Nordstrom black hole, but in the context of Kaluza-Klein theory. So you're looking for an F, which is going to look like Q sine theta, d theta, d phi in the four-dimensional space. So that's like a topological term, okay? So you've already explored the gauge fields that you can have for this. But in the context of doing a Ryson and Nordstrom solution, which is sort of like a Dirac-type monopole, you were simply looking at patching two gauge patches for the electromagnetic gauge field. So at that point, you were just looking at it as some sort of gauge field painted onto space-time. Whereas here, you know that the gauge field has a geometric interpretation. It's the cross term of the metric. So here, this patching has actually got a geometric meaning, and it's going to correspond to a coordinate change, right? So in this case, you know that the transformation between the two. So if I look to get from here to here, I've got to add 2q d phi. This has to be an allowable coordinate transformation. So what that means is if I define a new coordinate psi primed to be 2q phi plus psi, then this also has to be a legitimate coordinate for the extra dimension. Now, we know that phi and phi plus 2 pi are the same points. So this tells me that psi prime has, if I add 2 pi to phi, I've got to get the same coordinate psi prime. Sorry. So we know that psi prime is identified, psi and psi prime have to be identified with length L. So this tells me that 4 pi q has to be some integer multiple of the length of the extra dimension. So this is telling me that in this case, my charge is quantized. So previously, you deduced quantization of charge by thinking of electron wave functions in the background of a monopole. There's no quantum stuff going on here. It's actually the fact that you're extra dimension is discrete, that's kind of providing you with this quantization of charge. Of course, that is related to the electric charge, but in this case, it's all classical geometry. So let me just write down the black hole solutions. So I've chosen the north patch here. But something interesting has actually now happened. We've actually changed the topology of the space at fixed R. So what we'll do, and this was actually the Calixti-Klein monopoles put forward by Gross, Perry, and Sorkin, we'll look at the extremal limit. So that's R plus, sorry, R minus tends to R plus, and I'm going to take N equal to 1. I'll tell you what happens when N is not 1 in a bit. So you see that if I take the extremal limit, all that happens is that now my dt squared becomes 1. So I've sort of lost any null surface. If I now look here at these factors in front of the angular terms, I've actually got that these two here are also becoming the same. So what I've done here is I've used the fact that 4 pi q equals l. I've rescaled my extra coordinate, and I've just pulled it out here as a common factor. But you notice that this thing is just r plus squared in this particular instance. Did I miss them out? What did I do that for? Ah, sorry, I must be a bit tired this morning, I think. I just got carried away. My apologies, you're right. It should be R plus over R. I'm not quite sure why suddenly. Got carried away with squaring every R in sight. So what I want to do now is to play this a very similar trick to my Euclideanization. If I look in here, just let's look at this angular piece. Here I've got a two-sphere, and its radius is going like, sorry, its area is going like 4 pi R squared. Here I've got my U1, I've got my circle. So I sort of just ignore the phi piece for the moment. But this is just a constant times this overall Schwarzschild-type potential. So as we move out to infinity, this is representing a circle of fixed size, whereas this is representing the standard increasing two spheres. So at constant R, you would think, by looking as R goes to infinity, you might think what you had was S2 cross S1. But that kind of ignores the effect of this 1 minus cos theta in d phi term, which is correcting d chi. So while we're in this northern coordinate patch, it looks like we're just sort of gluing a U1 on every point of the sphere. So if you think of it as like chainmail, you're just sort of sewing on, stitching on these little rings in the northern part of the hemisphere. But I could have chosen the other coordinate patch. And in fact, I have to if I'm doing a full d describing the full space-time. And in the southern coordinate patch, the picture looks the same. I'm sewing my little chainmail onto the bottom half of the sphere. But if this thing really had topology S2 cross S1, then when I stitched my two halves together, I would simply be identifying the rings along the equator in a sort of obvious way, in a direct fashion. Except my coordinate transformation to get from one patch to the other is not straightforward. It's telling me that as I go around the equator, when I have to just twist a little bit as I'm matching the two coordinate patches together. So what this means is, as I take my chainmail and look around the equator and on each side, as I sew the rings together along the equator, when I identify, I've got to, as I move around, just twist each ring by through phi. So by the time I've come back to where I started, I've actually performed a full twist of each ring. And this changes the topology of this three space to actually that of an S3. So it's no longer S2 cross S1, it's actually an S3. And the easiest way to see that is by looking down, in this particular case, down near R equals R plus. So this is what you get if you make that coordinate transformation. It's very like, it's very analogous to what we do with the Euclidean black hole. And in this case, what's happening as we go down to R equals R plus, we've got an R minus R plus factor here, so that's our rho squared. And so this here is now looking like the rho squared plus rho squared times some angular, three-dimensional set of angles. And this is actually just a different way of coordinatizing S3. It's using Euler angles. So S3 is like a group manifold of the sort of double cover of SO3. And this is just one way of parameterizing it. Maybe we can set a question on that for tomorrow or something. So if n equals 1, that's what you get. If n is greater than 1, you get what's known as a lens space, which is basically something with a few identifications. So this is an example of a hot fibration. So it means that this Kaluza-Klein monopole is non-singular, and it's topologically R5. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's a square. D chi plus 1 minus cos theta d phi. Yeah, just from over there. All right. It's my scribbles, usually square. That's probably why I carried on squaring the R's. When you're writing metric, usually squaring it. So it's a process of thinking, I've got to keep squaring. OK. So that's Kaluza-Klein theory, which could be summed up more or less as saying small extra dimensions. So actually, with this Kaluza-Klein monopole, This is actually what produces a D6 brain in string theory. So, you know, if you add an extra, let's see, 6 dimensions to this solution, then you produce a 6 brain. And it's basically a reduction of 11-dimensional supergravity down to 10 dimensions. So your Kaluza-Klein direction is now an 11th direction. So if you want to do a little bit of digging around in gravitational solutions, that's quite a fun one to look at. So large extra dimensions is another acronym, LED. And the subtext of this is that it's a different way of compactification, which is known as a brain world paradigm, or brain worlds. So as a sort of motivating feature of this, notice that when I did this Kaluza-Klein reduction, my 1 over 16 pi g prefactor went to L over 16 pi g5, which I would associate with 1 over 16 pi, well, let me call it g Newton. So in other words, to get my 4-dimensional gravitational constant, it's a combination of a higher dimensional gravitational constant and the size of the extra dimension. Another way of writing this might be that, writing it in terms of the Planck mass. So in 5 dimensions, g5 is length cubed, or mass cubed. So this goes to m5 cubed L over 2. So that tells me that my Planck mass squared is m5 cubed L. So in other words, my 4-dimensional Planck mass is no longer some fundamental constant. It's a combination of a higher dimensional Planck mass and the size of the internal dimensions. So in Kaluza-Klein theory, traditionally, it had been assumed that the length of the internal dimension was of the same order as the Planck scale, so that the Planck scales in 5 and 4 dimensions were roughly the same. But if we just think about this more generally, so if I have now an arbitrary number of extra, if I'm living in some arbitrary number of dimensions, then if I want to reduce down to 4 dimensions, roughly speaking, I might get an L for every dimension I reduce on. So if I've got n extra dimensions, I would get L to the n. And then I have to have the relevant factor of the higher. Yep.
Why did you minus 2?
So this is just from dimensional grounds. Every time you step up a dimension, you get an extra dimension in your gravitational constant. So you can think of that because your Einstein action is just the integral d to the nx of r. R is not changing dimensionally. It has dimensions of L to the minus 2. So every time you add a dimension, you're integrating over an extra length. So g has to pile on an extra L in its dimensionality. Well, that's just how you define the Planck mass. 1 over 8 pi g. Or it could be 1 over g. There's all this big, you know, but I mean, 1 over 8 pi difference between them. We didn't used to care about factors of 1 over 8 pi. But we do now. Okay. So I could invert this, I know what the 4D Planck mass is, so I can actually invert this relation to get an expression for my length, my typical Kaluza-Klein scale. So just inverting that, I've simply got to take this whole formula to the 1 over n, and then I've just chosen to actually pull out a ratio of the Planck mass in 4D to the Planck mass in higher dimensions. And so I just simply say that the Planck mass in 4D is roughly, although admittedly this is probably knowing me out by a factor of 8 pi, but anyway, I only want a rough argument here. So, roughly speaking, my Kaluza-Klein scale can be given by my higher dimensional Planck scale. And I've sort of tried to put it in suggestive units, yes? Yeah, you're probably right, isn't it? Yep. Otherwise, if we were in D equals 4, we would... Thank you. Yeah, because I want that to go to L to the N. Yep. Where N's the number of extra dimensions. Actually, watch out. I have a feeling, like I say, it's me who's now sort of... acting as if I've sort of had a night on the town today, so watch out. There's probably going to be one or two things like that happening. So that what this is saying is that if we had a situation where our higher dimensional Planck mass was just sort of hovering somewhere near the TV scale, in other words, just within reach, then we can see, depending on the number of extra dimensions, our compactification scale can actually be relatively large. So if I just put in some numbers, so if I look at n is about 2, then L is somewhere of a millimeter, just below, somewhere a little below millimeter scale. And if I put n equals 3, then we're now sort of down at something like a sort of wavelength of light type of scale. So what this means is that from a gravitational point of view, once we get below sort of, well, we can go a bit below a millimeter testing Newtonian-type gravity, but we don't get much below 0.1 of a millimeter. So from an experimental point of view, gravitationally, we can't really rule these out. But clearly, these scales are huge from a particle physics point of view, okay? And so that means we have to find a way of not seeing them. So this is why Kalitzer and Klein said they that they were extremely small originally. So this is what, this is why this sort of vague argument, which is now bringing down the scale of gravity from being sort of 16 orders of magnitude different to the standard sort of standard model scale, to bringing it down to being much closer to the standard model scale. And it does it geometrically by providing a set of internal dimensions. So gravity sort of spreads out across this internal manifold, and we see it as being much weaker than it actually is. So it's a different way of explaining the hierarchy between standard model particle physics and gravitational physics. But obviously, for this to work, you've got to be able to hide these extra dimensions from standard model particles. So this introduces a new idea of confinement. We have to confine our particles into a four-dimensional submanifold. And so typically, we call these submanifolds now brains. And so hence the term brain world, because the four-dimensional submanifold is our world. It's our universe. So to see why or how this could happen, I'm just going to give a very rough outline. This is kind of a slight digression, so I don't want to go into it in huge detail, but the first time this cropped up was in the early 80s in a paper by Rubikov and Shaposhnikov, who were thinking about, at the time, topological defects are very fashionable in cosmology, and they sort of thought, well, what happens if one of these defects is our four-dimensional world? So it's like our universe as a domain wall. So they imagined that the space-time was five-dimensional. So just a toy model to explore what can happen. So this is like an alternative to the Kalitzer-Klein theory that we derived. And we have a scalar field living in our space-time. Get my factors right. So it's got a double well potential. So this is a real scalar with a double well potential. There are two vacua, minus and plus. And so we've got our equation of motion for the scalar. And we could imagine, just like a ferromagnet, we can have different domains where spins are either aligned or counter to a magnetic field. We could imagine a situation where one half of the universe was in the minus vacuum and the other half of the universe was in the plus vacuum. And this has, as I've sketched, This actually can happen. There's a solution to your equations of motion proportional to tanh. This solution is called the kink, for obvious reasons. And it has a very strongly localized energy. So if this is like E, it looks roughly like such to the fourth of Z over root lambda eta. And it's got an eta to the fourth in front of it. Eta squared. So what this kink is, it looks very much like a wall in the space-time. It's something with codimension one, and it's sharply localized. So this is codimension one, and it's sharply localized. So that's an example of a brain world as a physical realization of some field theory. Now, suppose I couple it to some fermion field, again in five dimensions. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the mass term of the fermion dependent on phi. And so what I've got is a situation where the mass is actually varying because phi is varying. So if I assume this is has a much lower energy than phi, so it's a small perturbation, and this actually has a solution proportional to sech. So it's not as sharply peaked as the energy, but it's still centered around the wall, and it's localized near the wall. This psi naught, so let's see. So what you've actually got to satisfy is I gamma phi psi prime is g eta tanh z times psi. And if I take I gamma 5 psi naught is minus psi naught, so this is like 0, 1, 1, 0, then I can solve it with this profile. So what this is telling me is that psi naught is chiral. And so this state has massless excitations. I can change psi naught here to psi naught of x, mu. And provided I make my four-dimensional psi now a massless fermion, it's still a solution to the 5D equations of motion. So what this is telling you is that low energy excitations of this Fermi field are like massless chiral fermions which move parallel to the wall. And so in other words, combined with the knowledge of this profile centered on the wall, this is saying that what you've got is some 4D theory living on the wall. Now, this is only a low-energy effective theory. If you try You know, if you go start pumping in a lot of energy, obviously things will go out into the fifth dimension. But this is meant to be some motivation for why you can stick onto a brain, because at first sight, it seems very, very odd, the idea that somehow a low gravity, because its geometry can see extra dimensions, particle physics can't. That seems very strange. But the more you look at it, the more you realize in a whole range of situations, this actually can occur. And here I've done it in the context of field theory, but hopefully when you start doing string theory next week, you'll actually see that in the context of D brains in string theory, D brains are defined as endpoints of open strings, Dirichlet boundary conditions. And in this case, because open strings carry charges, you sort of also have this interpretation of a lower dimensional gauge theory in the context of string theory. So that's a very different setup, but it's coming up with the same basic picture. You've got something which is sharply localized, and it has four-dimensional fields living on it. So that's the sort of outline and motivation of brain worlds. So what we want to do now is to come back in with our gravity toolkit and start to make this, flesh this out a bit. So what I want to talk about is something called the Israel equations. So I mentioned this when I was talking about making, you know, approximating surfaces in general relativity by making them infinitesimally thin. When I first derived this formalism for submanifolds, I actually was saying that, you know, one way in which you can meet a submanifold is as a brain. So so we derived our gravitational action as an Einstein-Hilbert term, an interior volume term, and a boundary term. And then we varied it. And then I'm going to assume, obviously, that the interior satisfies the Einstein equations. So remember, we chucked away this term because we said that delta m was 0. So we've already shown this. This is just bringing it back to mind. So what I want to do now is to think about a thin shell of matter. So I'm thinking about that brain world, that domain wall, or some other. Yep. Yeah. Sorry, this is meant to be the boundary of the manifold, DDM, whatever that backwards D is called. It's a fancy name for it. / partial. So what I'm imagining here is that I have some energy very tightly compressed. So this is something which stands out. This is going to be a strong source. So the idea is this T mu nu is very strongly localized. So I'm going to think of my space-time as being of two halves. I'm going to approximate it as being of two halves, where I'm now going to try and glue those two halves together. And what we're going to see is that if I have to, when I'm stitching the two halves together, if I have to kind of put some work into it, sort of squeeze things around to make it fit, put tension into the process, then that corresponds to a source, something that's like a delta function source localized along this common boundary. So we've got a sort of n plus and an n minus here. And this is my submanifold, which is delta of m minus or delta of m plus. So I'm going to take whatever my thin shell is, and I'm just going to take a zero thickness limit and call that a boundary of two halves of the space-time. So what I now, just for the purpose, it's just one of these annoying sign things. So what I want to do is I want to reverse the sign of n minus so that if I was thinking about this as a complete manifold, my normal would sort of go through n, and it would correspond to some coordinate which was telling me how far away I was from this wall. So in other words, if I'm on the right-hand side, my distance is positive. On the next left-hand side, I'm calling it negative. So in other words, I've got my wall. Here is my normal direction z, and I'm simply taking that the normals sort of look, you know, look like they're continuous, at least in direction. So H, the first fundamental form of the manifold, is H plus NN on each side. But if I want to glue these together, if this is a physical space-time, then my internal manifold has to be the same no matter which side I come at it. So that's saying that the two boundaries are identical. So I've got continuity of my parallel metric as I go through this blip of matter. Note this does not require g plus equals g minus, okay? We can have very different spacetimes on either side of the wall. So now all I do is look at my variation. And so because I've flipped the sign of the normal on the minus side, I have to subtract that KAB term that arises from the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. And so what I get is minus 1 over 8 pi g I'm keeping the half out for so that I can do a quick identification with energy momentum. So what I now get is a jump in extrinsic curvature. But of course, when I vary the action with respect to the metric, I also, that gives me, this is going to meant to give me like the left-hand side of the Einstein equations. I've also got to think about the right-hand side. And so I want to think about what an energy momentum source might be. And if I'm imagining that I have a very strong but very localized energy momentum, I can approximate that by an action which just lives on this boundary. So I know how to get an energy momentum tensor for this. So my energy momentum tensor, actually. So normally, if we want an energy momentum tensor, we vary the action with respect, the matter action with respect to the metric. This is living on sigma. Normally, I would vary my full n-dimensional action. If I want to get an integral dnx root g, what I've notionally got to do, I can make this sort of more rigorous, is I would have to put a delta function. So I can think of this as my higher dimensional manifold times a delta function. So this is going to give me a delta function form for TAB. So I'm sort of mixing a little bit two points of view here, but so if I vary my brain action with respect to the metric in the brain, then that gives me my brain energy momentum. I can think about it as from a physical perspective as being a delta function in the higher dimensions. So what you can think about this as being like, because you might think how I've made my manifolds continuous. Now I'm saying they're not quite the same. So a very easy way of seeing how you could do that is by taking mirror images. So suppose I take just the plane r squared, and I put a cut through the plane like this, so that's one side of my space with a boundary, all I have to do is make sure that the local metric is the same. I could take a mirror image cut over here. So this would be like m minus, m plus. These two curves look the same intrinsically. Extrinsically, they're different because they're curving in opposite ways. So if you want to glue these two together, you could do it, but you can't do it remaining in the plane. You'd have to lift into some third dimension to make these two sit together properly. And this is indicative. Of energy momentum. So that was that image of having tension with stitching things together. They wanted to get across. And the Israel equations tell you exactly how this energy momentum relates to the discrepancies in extrinsic curvatures. So it's telling me, so this factor of a half is exactly compensated by that factor there. So it tells me that delta KAB minus delta KHAB is equal to 8 pi G SAB. And these are the Israel equations. So what this is telling us how to do is how to, this is now a very firm way of deriving a description of a delta function within general relativity. So this actually should be mildly surprising, because general relativity is, of course, highly nonlinear. And therefore, you might think if you tried to compress a source into a small space, the nonlinearities would get you. After all, that's what happens with a black hole. It's where you've tried to compress matter into too small a space. But what this is telling you, the fact that you can do this completely rigorously, although I've probably smudged a few lines here, this is telling you that you can actually do this if all that you're doing is squashing it in one dimension only. So it means that you can actually take a zero thickness limit along one direction in general relativity. And roughly speaking, the way that you can, the reason you can do that is because with all the antisymmetries in the Riemann tensor, if you only ever do it in one direction, that direction never sort of comes back to hit itself from the point of view of the Einstein equations. So it's the curvature, the Einstein equations don't become nonlinear in that transverse direction. So these are the Israel equations, and we'll see them in action tomorrow.